This episode of The Stack was first broadcast on the 15th of November, 2014, on Monocle 24.
Artfully delivered news weeklies, or well-executed art journalism, from literature to finance and from art curation to photography, will be getting stuck into the stacks of magazines that are keeping our two guests up to speed as we focus on the best to pick up in print. All that today on edition 116 of The Stack. This week on The Stack, we'll get flicking as we rifle through some titles, as suggested by George Brock and Robert Shore, bringing us to very different areas of expertise, one current affairs and one the arts. And we'll be looking across the English Channel to France, where some might say state subsidies are causing more harm than good. Plus, we'll be visiting the offices of an Austrian magazine on a mission to change attitudes.
We kind of address our readers as checkers between worlds. Maybe they're born here or they came here when they were very young. And also they're still like in the world of their origins.
All that and plenty more besides on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. Robert Shore is editor of visual culture quarterly Elephant. He has worked in art and illustrated publishing, both magazines and books, for over 20 years. And during that time, among other things, he served as a theater and music critic across a wide selection of press. Today, I'm also joined on the program by George Brock, who is professor of journalism at City University here in London. George is an avid media watcher. Last year, he charted the rise and fall and future of print in a book out of print and continues to follow international print trends. Welcome, and gentlemen, great to have you both here. I just wanted to start off, because I know you've both brought lots of things in, but a little while ago, Nouvel Observateur, relaunched as L'Obs now, as it's called, looks sort of vaguely, there's shades of New York magazine in it. Certainly, I think if you look at the front and the front cover and the use of fonts and strap lines, etc. But it is amazing. Every time you're in France, it's an incredible market to look at because there are still so many new launches coming out of there from traditional companies, new publishers as well. And I guess, of course, we always talk about a lot of people self-publishing on this program. But France is that one market where you see sort of the old boys, still out there, they're doing it. I know that you're quite interested in the theme of also subsidies that exist on that side of the channel. And we can get, Robert, your view also on the design of L'Obs in a second. But I just wanted to start with you, George, your sort of thoughts, quick thoughts, when you sort of look at the state of print and France right now.
Well, I don't think that I would necessarily tie the creation of new magazines to the subsidy regime, although it probably helps. There's a guy who happens very helpfully, a journalist called Sébastien Fontanel, has just rounded up for all of us where they are with subsidies. And they spend about 5 years, they spent 5 billion euros subsidizing print publications of one kind or another. Mm. And the estimate is that's about 15% of the turnover of the industry. So we're talking substantial scale of help here. And the weird bit about it is that there is absolutely no longer any rhyme or reason about who gets the money. In other words, there's no regime that says, for example, if you'd like to relaunch your magazine, we will give you an extra bit. They subsidize all 4 TV listings magazines in France. 4 TV listing magazines, what is that about? Nobody can understand. They're almost completely indistinguishable, as it happens. And the funniest irony of all is they give money to a celeb magazine called Closer, which was the one that actually did the story on President Hollande and his nocturnal expeditions on a scooter, if you remember, to see his lady
friend. Yes, we recall that.
Well, it's a weird system because it has no rhyme or reason or sense to it. All these newspapers, including the ones like Figaro and Le Monde, which get some subsidy under this system, spend a lot of their time telling the French government to cut its expenditure. You'll have noticed there are some economic arguments going on in France about this kind of thing. They do not very prominently report how much money they get. The state spending watchdog in France, back in 1985, it said, the system, it makes no sense and it doesn't work. They said it again in 2013. Nobody in the media or anywhere else has taken a blind bit of notice. It's a really silly situation. They're not the only country to do it, I should hasten to say.
No, even my homeland of Canada, if you look in pretty much any Canadian magazine, you will see that there's some type of grant, you know, given in that market as well. But I wanted to come to you, just your view on state subsidies. You know, lots of other institutions, of course, get government grants. Why not a print startup?
Yeah, well, I mean, the anxiety is usually that obviously if the state is paying it money, then it's going to obey the state in terms of what it reports. And obviously the closer story and President Hollande proves that that's not the case. So maybe that is a case then actually for subsidies being possible in a way that, you know, where we tend to have anxieties about why we shouldn't have subsidies. Does it make for better journalism? Of course, it's another matter.
But I think the strongest argument against it is that it's an innovation killer. If you're looking at magazines and how they adapt to changing circumstances, digital disruption, and a whole load of other stuff, fear does matter in this kind of business. If you are a magazine without subsidy and there's no safety net beneath you and you are having to do some adapting because your market is changing, the demography is changing, technology or whatever it happens to be, you must change.
Yeah, but what if you're in the Silicon Roundabout in London, George? I mean, there's no shortage of digital startups in this country which are getting some type of subsidy. So if I'm sitting there trying to be in a media landscape, trying to run my very, very good print idea, which might sort of morph into something digital, and you know, Downing Street is offering up money to tech startups, doesn't seem entirely fair.
Well, there's a large cluster of talent already in this country for print. If the government is doing this sensibly, what it should say is, we want a really strong cluster of digital stuff too, and we're prepared to encourage that for a bit. I'm not completely against subsidy in any circumstances. What I don't like about subsidy, and the French example is a classic one, is subsidy that just rolls on because nobody can be bothered to do anything about it.
Mm. Robert, if it when we're in territory, when, of course, you know, someone's sitting there sort of dreaming with A4 and a pencil as to what their cover could look like and what their first flat plan looks like, is that okay? And I'm going down the track of, If it was the case in this market or the US where the likes of TV Guides and Radio Times were getting subsidies, is that perhaps a little bit wrong?
I mean, actually, I'm against the idea of state subsidy for print journalism. But I mean, it's not a level playing field in any case.
But you say journalism because you would have to also separate it because, you know, someone might say, yes, I've got a nice arts magazine. I'm not going to be taking down governments with it. But, you know, I am celebrating a variety of sectors, etc. I feel that this is an instrument of soft power. Maybe it is good if I get some kind of funding from a council.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose so. At the same time, one can partner up with various other organisations that are not necessarily carrying their message through print that do receive sponsorship. So, I mean, there is a kind of drip-down effect, actually. And I don't know that it needs to go directly to the press. And certainly, even working, you know, on an art magazine, I would hate to feel that there was no kind of news value. And therefore, if you want to keep subsidies away from the area of news reporting, then actually it would have no place in journalism generally.
Let's just maybe close the circle, just your observations, both of you, on L'Obs, on Nouvelle Observatoire. I guess for those who don't remember it, of course, we're talking about a news weekly in France. It had almost a rather academic, bordering sometimes on annual report, masthead across the top. They've gone for something sort of quite big and bold on the front cover right now. Robert, I'll start with you. Just sort of first impressions as a Newsweekly. I find it incredibly dense, but not sure what you think.
Yeah, no, it's quite difficult to sort of thrash your way through it. I mean, I like the title L'Obs, which, you know, works beautifully in English. Obviously,
yes,
it means something quite different. So it's obviously a throwable object, which is great. I mean, beyond that, it's quite difficult to find, if this is really about journalism, then it's quite difficult to find stories, isn't it? But, you know, it comes at you in quite a brash fashion. You know, nice photography, lots of colour.
Lots of TV listings as well.
Very difficult to find your way between editorial and advertising, which is so commonplace.
Does it get a pass?
I wouldn't have picked it up based on the cover. I mean, just the red and the green on the cover would have killed it for me.
Mm. George?
It's very, very slow. It's a bit magazine design slowed down, I would say. I think you're right that it's dense. It barely gets a pass from me. There's no very strongly consistent style note here that tells me that it's a different kind of magazine and what kind of different magazine it is. This is a very crowded sector, and it's a very crowded bit of the market in France. I think you've got to be more distinctive than this to think that it's going to make much difference to you.
Let's, you've both brought in print to look at today. Do you want to start with your New York Review of Books, George? One that a lot of people love dearly and for its just all quirkiness, because it doesn't quite do what it says on the label almost.
Yes, you're right. It's a magazine that is oblique in one sense, in that you learn about the world via learning about books, and it's very much books about the world of telegrams and anger. There is a certain amount of reviewing of fiction, but I don't think anybody on the NYRB would pretend that fiction was its big thing. I've loved it for a very long time. One of the reasons that I think you stay loyal to it for a very long time is not so much what's on the cover or particular books, but it's the consistency of the standard of the editing.
Mm.
I mean, and I'm not talking about whether I find literals in it or little, you know, typographical mistakes. I'm just talking about the fact that none of it is ever wasted, that clearly it has been worked over and over and over again in the right kind of way, and they do this fortnight in, fortnight out, year after year. Basically, the same guy in charge of the process, and by golly, that works well.
And when you talk about it working well, the other side too is, yes, thorough, all of that, but also it simply just doesn't really move on from a design point of view very much, partly because do you think they just did it right the first time?
Yeah, I it's a text-heavy publication. It has short headlines. They have relatively few illustrations.
Mm.
They stick to what they're good and what they know. Okay, they're at risk that their readership is getting older. I've never looked at the figures. I don't know. I would guess their readership might be getting older. But it doesn't seem to worry them very much because the editor's getting a lot older.
Is the size of the type getting bigger? Because that's a sign about the age of the readership.
Right.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. It would be a clue. As far as I know, it hasn't changed. But that's a very good question
any of us know, it all starts to shift as well when you probably sort of get, you know, more than sort of three or four letters after an issue from people saying, you know, could the point size just go up, you know, by two? Robert, are you a fan? Do you spend much time with it?
Yes, I am a fan, and of those papers and journals that save you from having to read the books in full, and instead, you know, you can read 1,500 words and it tells you. Of course, it's killing publishing in some ways that, you know, you get to read a digest of all of the books you ought to be reading, but actually you just read it in the New York Review of Books instead. I mean, I do think, again, actually, even then, though, there's that suggestion that this is a digest that everybody ought to be reading. I think more people buy it than actually look through it. I mean, I was coming back from New York last week and bought a copy of The New Yorker and thought, splendid, I'm going to read this, and then actually found it impossible to keep my eye on the page for more than 3 minutes.
Right. And that's not that classic New Yorker moment of you weren't maybe in the right place or the right mind space on the aircraft saying that I will come back to it next week, and then it's shredded at the bottom of your tote bag. That's sort of what happens to mine anyway.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And also it's very difficult to commission week in, week out, really good 5,000 word pieces, actually.
Yeah, and to find the time to also wade through them.
Yes, exactly. And who's there to read them? But it's good to know that it exists. And I think, you know, that's important.
Though I have to say there was, I think it was Patricia Marks. I don't know if you read the piece on emotional support animals. I mean, if anyone has time, it is one of the most brilliant pieces of New Yorker journalism I've read in a while, where she just challenges the whole notion of what is a service animal and what is an emotional support animal. And she gets a llama and a turtle and a snake and a pig. And she just goes and challenges the whole absurd nature that you can actually sort of even, you know, if you need it to sort of make you feel better about flying. And she actually gets on an aircraft, a JetBlue flight, with a pig. With a pig.
Sure it wasn't going to be the pig.
No, it was extraordinary as well. She said, you walk down the aisle of an aircraft with a child, and she said, you might as well have a sort of machine gun in your hand. But she was, everyone is just, you know, the passengers were squealing with delight because they love the pig. Anyways, it was, if anyone hasn't read it, you should. Just quickly, you've also got a newspaper at the top of your stack there, Mirror City. Why have you brought that in today?
Okay, well, because it's not a newspaper, really. It's a series of artists working in London, in and around the capital, who are in various ways responding to contemporary life. And increasingly that, our digitized reality and the way that our screen-based world impacts on our experience of the physical world. Mm. That gives rise to a variety of different kinds of artworks, where you cannot often see the link, actually, to the thematic that underlies the exhibition. But they've created, it's Tom McCarthy who's edited this, a response from writers and artists, which takes the form of a tabloid newspaper. And it's interesting, that, you know, is that just an expression of nostalgia that you would you would go for that? This is part of then the catalogue for the exhibition. And so, have we already moved away so far from print that there's room for a kind of nostalgic comeback? Is that it? I mean, obviously, it is one of the ways that we engage with cities as well, through print journalism. I mean, we're very used to that idea that actually it tells us the story of particularly urban spaces. And this newspaper is very nicely done. It has some wonderful headlines. The universe really is a hologram, according to new simulations, which I think is you know, beautifully surreal realization. Lots of work with found imagery as well. A great use of Margaret Thatcher.
And it's just looking at also from a layout point of view, it's great how they've also borrowed things from so many places. And I'm feeling rather nostalgic. They're looking at actually some designs from sort of the New York Times, classic New York Times pages from about a decade ago that they sort of played on, which is great.
Yeah, no, there's great love for that. But I mean, there is an anxiety that it's already a comeback from a world that really, from seen in that way, has already vanished. It's gone. There's no question.
We're going to vanish for a very brief moment here. You're listening to The Stack. My guests today, George Brock and Robert Shore. We'll be back right after this.
Monocle Films visits a trio of women's wear designers in London, Brussels and Copenhagen, daring women to dress in a different way.
There's two different markets in a way. There's like the fashion market, which is really unappealing to me. And then there's the clothing market, which is much more appealing, and making good quality products.
Women's Wear Heroes, our latest Monocle briefing film, now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé, George Brock and Robert Shore of Elephant Magazine. And now to Austria, a country that has traditionally been a meeting point between Eastern and Western Europe. It has a large and diverse immigrant population, many from the ex-Soviet states and the Arab world. But despite this multiculturalism, it is also a country where right-wing views enjoy much public support, with the ultra-nationalist Freedom Party gaining 21% at the last parliamentary elections a year ago. In this atmosphere, it is often hard for immigrant communities in Austria to get their voices and concerns heard. That's a situation that a monthly current affairs magazine called Das Biber is trying to change. It's run by immigrants for immigrants, and it comes with a journalism school for budding immigrant journalists in Austria. Our correspondent in Vienna, Alexei Korolyov, met up with the editorial team behind it.
It was 15 years ago that this man first made the international headlines. That's Jörg Haider, the late leader of Austria's far-right anti-immigration Freedom Party. A highly controversial politician notorious for his pro-Nazi statements, Haider led the Freedom Party to second place at the general election in October of 1999, its biggest success to date. Jörg Haider may be long gone, but his party and his message remain strong in Austria. The Freedom Party came third at the general election last year and did well in the Europarliament election this May. A key factor in the party's continued success is its harsh rhetoric on immigration, a hot topic in Austria and indeed all over Europe. And yet, despite the presence of such views, Austria is home to many immigrant communities. These communities are anxious to have a greater say in domestic politics, as well as make their own culture and problems known to the Austrian public at large. And since 2006, they've had a mouthpiece with which to do that, Das Biber, a current affairs magazine that makes a point of employing immigrant journalists who report about immigrant life. Let's hear from Deputy Editor-in-Chief Delna Antia and Head of Advertising Adam Bezhetsky.
We kind of address our readers as checkers between worlds. Maybe they're born here or they came here when they were very young. And also they're still like in the world of their origins, of their family. We have like different sections. Politics is, it's a main section, it's very important for us. And also we call it like Rambazamba. It's love, it's life, it's, you know. Then also we have a section which is focused on career. And yeah, and then we have techniques and lifestyle. It's very important because we have a very stylish community.
Vienna used always to have big immigrant communities, so we still have big parts in ex-Yugoslavian and Turkish communities, but there are also the smaller Russian, Bulgarian, Hungarian, Eastern Europe, yeah, immigrants from Eastern Europe who come to the city and see Biber as a nice way to express the things they are experiencing and make it, you know, publicly available. Oftentimes, because our access to the communities, we get the stories first, the real interesting that no one else has. And afterwards, it gets picked up by the mass media. And we are also always named as the source material. So there was an example last October. We were the first to report about, you know, these foreign fighters that are recruited partly in Vienna. And at that time, no major publication wanted to pick the story up because they said it was, this is not interesting. And now it's a year later and this is everywhere in the headlines. So stories need to be visual to be seen. And we have a great emphasis on that. So we fret on every photo and try to take the best ones to make a story really live and to attract the attention.
When the magazine was first launched in 2006, its employees were paid in food, or so they say. But today, it's a profitable business, with most of the money coming from advertising. Adam, again.
There's a big competition between magazines, printed magazines, but because of our unique target group, companies recognize us as an asset. We are not getting the main ad revenue of one company, of course not, because we are not a daily magazine, but we still have that edge that we have these connections to the communities and that we bring stories that people really read. So our reach is about 200,000 readers each month.
Das Biber also runs something called Biber Akademie, a school for young would-be journalists co-founded by the government and private sponsors. Here's Delna to explain what it's all about.
And it's also a purpose of our academy that we change the landscape of media in Austria. We want to get migrants, young journalists with migrant background, into the media. We have the academy where they come like for 2 months, and after the 2 months, it's not over, but it's going into mass media like Kurier, like radio, like ORF, like wherever.
In fact, Biber Akademie graduates are now employed in media all across Austria, which means that the immigrants' concerns are now more and more present in the national press. But it all began here, in this office. Maite Dedigic edits several sections at Das Biber.
And before there was Biber, you know, the journalists from the main media, they just wouldn't talk about the topics that young migrant people are interested in. They wouldn't tell their stories. And then there came Biber, and someone was finally telling the stories about so many people who are living here. And this quite changed the media escape.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Quite interesting. You're talking about things coming full circle. There's part of this that it reminds me of activist journalism in the 1980s as well. I think when we started to see the likes of Big Issues and the copycats around the world, and it reminds me of many things that I saw even on the streets of the other side of the border, but in Germany as well. Just I guess your just reactions and impressions to this.
Well, I mean, it made me think of the Big Issue. Mm. I picked it up and. It's a great story itself, isn't it? I mean, how can you not admire that? And wouldn't it be nice if we had a similar thing here? Mm. I think, you know, that's probably a good idea.
George, it's interesting just to hear also the fact that that they want to, you know, obviously have a talent pool as well. And you know, I've not spent a lot of time in too many Austrian newsrooms, but certainly what I guess you were hearing is how are you also able to bring the immigrant community, you know, more into, you know, certainly into the Austrian mainstreams, the ORFs, etc. Thoughts on that?
I think they've fastened very quickly and early onto an idea that is beginning to grow. I've come across that idea somewhere else. I'm actually helping a high-tech magazine which has got a very, very small, informal academy of people because it doesn't want to hire lots of expensive journalists. It can't afford to, so it wants to grow its own.
Mm. Are journalists even expensive anymore? I'm wondering.
Well, good ones can be. Ones can be. That's the problem. And so I think, in fact, you're going to see this idea replicated elsewhere. Now, obviously, it has a really big, in the Austrian circumstances just being described, it has a really big cultural and social importance. And if they're managing to get people employed all over the mainstream Austrian media, then they're doing something right.
Mm. We've probably got time for one more magazine from each of you. I can see, George, you've got the Spectator there. I can see Prospect. I can see Private Eye. Which one do you want to go for?
Well, I'm going to talk about the Spectator partly because it has a piece called "The Pleasures of Reading Print" by Matthew Paris, which I'm sure is going to be required reading in this office. Both the Spectator and the New Statesman, which is often paired as a rival, are actually in terrific shape at the moment. They're really well edited. They have lots of very good ideas. They are very good examples of how really good editorial content comes from a team and not a single individual. Really confident editors who are confident of employing very good people right around them. and it's doing terrifically well, and they're just starting on the Christmas book season, which keeps me going for quite a lot of the next year. In fact, the one-off supplement that I would really like is an aggregated set of everybody's Christmas book selections. Then I could consult it the whole of the following year.
Right, just before we go.
I have one question for George, which is actually, do book reviews generally prompt you to buy books?
Quite often, yes. Okay. Mm. And I mean, they read them so I don't have to, is one part of it. It doesn't stop me reading a book, but what it does do is direct my attention to books that I might actually really get the most value out of. Mm.
And I have one question. Do you read off of the good old printed page, or do you reading off of a Kindle?
I read more off the printed page than I do off the Kindle. I have a Kindle, but I much prefer reading off the printed page.
And you've sort of made your decision now? It's always an interesting discussion at this time of year as well. Where is the money going to be spent? You've sort of just probably decided that you prefer paper for a book?
Or? Well, I'm old-fashioned. I encourage people to give me books as presents, and I give other people books presents. But sometimes when you're traveling, a Kindle is an awful lot more efficient.
Robert, you've got your own title there, your own very fine title, but you've got the world of interiors, you've got other things. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you'd like to talk. Do you want to do Elephant or the black and white issue of a world of interiors?
I'll do Elephant simply because so Elephant is a visual culture quarterly, and by visual culture that means we do kind of contemporary art but also into illustration. I mean, anything where people are being creative visually. Mm. So we've just relaunched, or we've redesigned at any rate, and one of our great discoveries is we now have these we use different paper stocks, and we have these lovely paper galleries pages where we try and show work without any comments. So it's almost as if we're just recreating a white cube gallery space in the magazine. It's almost as though it's undesigned. Of course, it's never undesigned. There's no such thing as no design. But what I've discovered is through doing slightly reduced size pages for these inserts is that it's actually made quite a lot of people who read the magazine believe that we've made the rest of the magazine bigger. So I think that's quite a clever trick. If you want people to think that you're actually going to, you know, that they're getting more for their money, put slightly smaller pages in the middle, and it often will make them believe the rest of the magazine has grown.
I always find slightly smaller sets of pages rather irritating. I grow to dislike magazines that do that.
Oh dear, you're not going to be buying Elephant.
You don't like this at all.
I don't understand this trend at all. I question this research.
Well, yeah, you like, because you can't sort of do a flip then, right? Because it sort of disrupts the whole thing.
Do you rip it out and undo the staples? And,
oh, I bet you do, don't you?
Well, I often do.
Or just bin the whole thing.
That also happens. It certainly goes further down the list.
I picked out the wrong design element there, didn't I?
Well, listen, I mean, if you've pulled sort of one design cue out of this program, fine. Gentlemen, that brings us to the end of this 116th edition of The Stack. My guests today, George Brock and Robert Shore. Our producer was David Pleasant. Our studio manager is Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes or SoundCloud. But for now, from me, Tyler Berlay, goodbye.